This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Ruth Todd and Maureen Rout. And today, Ruth, I've got a third collection of poems by Christchurch poet Karen Sharp. It's called Louder, and I think she is getting louder.
Yes, she certainly is. Wonderful launch at the festival. And yes. I've got a book that I'm really proud about. Lizzie Marvely has written The F Word, Growing Up Feminist in Aotearoa, and it's brilliant. It should be in every secondary school library, at least 5 copies. And, she's nailed it, I think, for the next generation who are growing up now.
Good on her.
In That F Word, Growing Up Feminist in Aotearoa, award-winning columnist, musician and activist Lizzie Marvely tells the story of New Zealand's feminist roots, exposes our gender imbalance, challenges the traditional expectations in New Zealand society, and celebrates the indomitable spirit of Kiwi women. She also shares her first-hand experiences of abuse, sexism and trolling, while shining a light on how young women are raised from birth and how they're usually conditioned in our schools. Welcome to the program, Lizzie.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be on the program.
Oh, it is indeed. And looking back to the festival, when you were on the panel 125 yes. years, have we got there yet? You all agreed that we haven't got there yet. But what I think you've done in this book is what compelled you to write it in the first place?
A number of things compelled me to write it. I mean, it kind of all ties back to when I started Villainess back in 2015. Villainess is a website that I started to share the opinions of other young women. And, my whole motivation for that was to have other young female voices heard. And I think that what I've really tried to do with a lot of my work is to kick down some doors so that other young women coming behind me will be able to do all of the incredible things that they want to do. So, I've grown up in New Zealand and I've been very aware of the inequalities that we still face. And then when I was presented with this opportunity to write a book, it just presented such an amazing kind of canvas for me to be able to talk about these issues and hopefully to be able to stimulate some discussion around them.
Well, I'm so glad you have done that, because I don't think there's another book that covers the issues as well as you have done in this. And
Thank you so much.
And that's the most important thing for me, to pick up a book that has all of the important issues in it and no punches spared.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I just tried to, be as straight up and honest about these issues as possible, and also to back them up with some good research. I learnt a lot. I mean, I knew these issues pretty well before I started writing, but through the process of the research, there were a number of things that came to light that I wasn't previously aware of.
Well, it's quite depressing for me, who was working in feminist areas in the 70s, 60s, 70s and 80s, and here we are 125 years on, and we don't seem any further forward. I can't believe. I thought we would sort it all then. And And we're still not looking hard enough at our culture, and we're not acting, are we?
No, I mean, I think that there is a lot of great work happening, and I have so much gratitude for the feminists of your generation, because without you we wouldn't be where we are now. But I think that really it's the responsibility now of our whole society to look at these issues, to start to really examine our culture and to make change. And I just think that we're not there yet, but we are on the right path. I do try to be an optimist throughout this whole thing.
Well, I certainly
think that we are getting there.
Yes, I do too, but I'm getting older and older, and I would like to, I want it to happen while I'm still around.
I I totally hear you. And I think with some of these things, I even worry that maybe they won't happen in my lifetime. But I have to stop thinking about that exactly and just keep ploughing on.
Well, it was sort of fortuitous because we're pre-recording this interview on last Thursday, and it's going to air on the Tuesday.
Yes.
But I did read an article in the press last Thursday morning that made me a little depressed because of the a case that came up in 2014, and it's been written by Michelle Duff, and I haven't heard about it before, but it's about a school teacher who was raped in a classroom by another teacher on the staff, and then somebody in the community also made a complaint to the police about the rape of her rape on the same day or the same week, and the police thought they had a good case, but the one woman in the community didn't feel safe about going ahead with it, and the teacher wanted to, but the school principal, who was male, and many of the staff, they were divided, and she was advised by the police not to go ahead or she'd be ripped to pieces in the courtroom. And it's, 2014 isn't far away, and it depresses me, but it was only last month, wasn't it, that we had to report our progress on gender equality to the United Nations Women's Rights Committee. And when it comes to workplace safety, we're not doing great. In 2017, 123 complaints of sexual harassment received by the Human Rights Commission alone. The Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment also takes complaints, but has only just begun counting them. And there's a 43% increase over the last 10 years. And they have been admonished by we've been admonished by the UN what we're not doing. And, when is it going to happen?
That's a very good question. And, you know, I think that even those statistics are not an accurate representation of what's actually happening out there. You know, I think that the people who are reporting, and certainly let's say in 2017, when the Me Too movement only really started to kick in the second half of the year. So I think that that number, the true number of, you know, unreported sexual harassment cases would be much, much, much larger. And really, that this is another cultural issue where it's wonderful that we are starting to see more reporting of these issues, but actually, you know, I'm with you. When is the change going to happen? Because these conversations are important, but we actually really need action. And I think part of the problem is that, I mean, obviously all of the old problems that we know about stigma and shame and all of the victim blaming and kind of slut shaming narratives that just permeate our society. But part of the problem also is the justice system. And it's exactly like the police were saying in that case. You know, I mean, the police, I think, can sometimes be part of the problem. But in this particular example, the justice system itself, the courtroom, I think is one of the major problems because, you know, it is so re-traumatizing for victims and survivors to have to go through that process, an adversarial kind of process where you've got the jury, which, you know, as any group from the community will hold a certain number of rape myths. So it's just like the deck is completely stacked against victims. And I don't know of any other crime, really, where it kind of turns out in practice that the victim is actually the one on trial.
I have hope now that Helen Clark is free from the political world and the United Nations. She has now just now become the patron of the National Council of Women, and one of her pleas is for both parties, both National Party and the Labour Party, Greens and New Zealand First, to get together on this kind of thing and to get together, especially she's saying domestic violence, which is just as bad. And she's saying if they can get together and work on one of these things, because there are so many issues, but let's choose one and really get it right.
Absolutely. And I think that kind of bipartisan or, you know, kind of multi-partisan now approach is really necessary for these issues, because these are not You know, I know it sounds a bit naive for me to say that these are not political issues, but I actually believe that they're not. They're societal issues. And the problem that we have here is that, and, you know, this is perhaps even why it's more fitting for the parties to work together, is that sexual violence and domestic violence don't discriminate according to politics. They don't discriminate according to socioeconomic status or any of those other demographics that may divide people politically. You know, women particularly are suffering from these things right across society. So I very much support what Helen is saying, in that it's really time for us to get together and address these difficult issues, because, you know, pretty much everyone would know someone who has been victimised, you know, either via domestic violence or sexual violence. So it really does touch, you know, almost everyone in our society.
I sort of have hope that all the good men will get out there and do something about it, but it doesn't seem to be happening that way.
Well, I really have hope about that too, and I do. I'm lucky to know a number of really good men.
Oh,
but
so
I
am
feel
I.
Like, yeah, absolutely. And I feel like, though, there's, I don't really know how to get past this, but there's some segments of male society, shall we say, that seem to feel quite threatened by these conversations. You know, they almost seem to take it personally. Like, you know, when you say, for example, that the majority of perpetrators in these crimes are male, they kind of take that as an affront to the whole male species. And I just think that that's kind of completely missing the point. And actually, you know, when we're talking about these issues, we're not saying that all men are bad. You know, there are lots of wonderful men out there, but we are saying that, you know, they are, you know, the perpetrators are largely male, and we do have to, I think, have a look at, you know, Kiwi masculinity and how there may be some parts of that that are, for some people, becoming kind of maladaptive, shall we say, or dangerous, you know, when they're taken to the extreme. And I think that it's just an open analytical approach that we need to take, where we're not making accusations against large groups of society, but we're actually just trying to work on it together.
I love your last paragraph, because that gives me hope. And I quote, "And last but certainly not least, to the bossy little girls and strong young women reading this book, thank you for inspiring me, energising me and making me excited about the future. You are so powerful. You give me hope. You are the bright, blazing light this world needs." So thanks.
And aren't they?
Aren't they? So thank you, Lizzie, for putting this book out. And I hope there are at least 5 copies in every secondary school library already. That's what's got to happen. And
Thank you so much.
And so, good luck with that F word, Growing Up Feminist in Aotearoa. The book is by Lizzie Marvely and published by HarperCollins. It's absolutely a book for these times.
Thank you.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains FM 96.9.
Louder. Elephants paint their faces to restore themselves, adding tusks where poachers took their ivory. These artists use soft sable brushes made in the Congo and paint their parents bathing in rivers, crossing Ugandan borders, or even birthing when hunters arrive. And if you can imagine thousands of elephants, all in outdoor studios, painting themselves and their tribe as whole elephants, even as guns are raised and calves stumble into scopes, even as trunks and heads are mutilated, their painting continues, louder than bullets.
That was Kieran P. Sharp reading from her latest collection, Louder. Kieran has published 4 collections now with Victoria University Press, and she's been published in a wide range of journals and anthologies in New Zealand and internationally. Kieran's a great teacher of creative writing, formerly at Hagley Writers Institute, but now at St Andrews, or you have been at St Andrews for some time and other schools as well. A very inspirational and wonderful teacher of creative writing. Kieran, this book really is louder. It's louder in lots of ways because you've always had political interests, but they've been more muted. But this time you're confronting us with a lot of poems about things that are going on that are wrong and distasteful and dreadful in the world.
Yes, that's right, Morin. And what happens in the collection, once I'd seen that terrible picture of the elephant with his tusks off, then the poems just started coming. And what was interesting to me when I tried to shape the collection and make it louder was that some of the poems were more muted and some of them were really loud. And it's like got the effect of turning the volume of a radio up and down. So the voices we try and push away, sometimes we're successful, but often they come back more insistent than ever.
Yes, and in the meantime, you have conquered, well, I don't know if you've conquered your fear of flying. You suppressed your fear of flying and you went overseas.
Yes.
And I can tell from some of these poems, these are reactions and reflections on the time that you've spent away.
Yes, I went to Britain and I took the collection and took a whole lot of stuff out and then wrote new stuff and then started to think how I would shape it in order for it to have more of an impact. And just being out of the teaching role and just into the quietness and looking at new things has done wonders, I think, for my work and for myself.
Yes, because there's still the whimsy there, you know, the little deer are still there in the forest coming in, coming and visiting us, but they've got a new import now. They're not just there as whimsical people, they're there with purpose.
Yeah, they are, and that whole thing of being threatened and unsafe.
Exactly. We're going to I'm going to ask you to read quite a few poems in this interview because I think they speak so loudly in the right way. What are you going to read next for us?
Well, talking of fear of flying, which I haven't overcome, and my mother also had it, a little poem called My Mother Darned the Windsock. My mother darned the windsock because flying put the wind up her. She grew up near the Rongotai Aerodrome. Her house never touched the ground. My mother delays flights by feeding birds near the hangars and loitering in restricted areas, especially the runway. When planes bring soldiers home, she's always there with the flag of Aotearoa, broken-hearted like any mother.
You see, your mother has turned up in probably every collection of yours. Yes. She was a milliner. She's a seamstress. But this time there's that real edge, isn't there, of sadness.
And that poem in some ways, like, wrote itself because from going and me thinking about how the wind got up her as it did for those women of that generation, it kind of turned into something more serious, really, of its own accord.
Exactly. And the collection is divided into these quite definite sections. And they've got, you know, very straightforward names.
Yeah, they have, like
Endangered.
Refugees.
Yes.
Beyond the Wire and Where Will the Fish Sleep? You know, I'm really asking the writer, the reader, you know, what are you going to do about this? You know, these are lingering questions I hope that go beyond the collection.
Exactly. So another poem.
So this is one from the refugee section and it's got a little companion piece called Wick. And when I was at Cambridge University on my little trip, I went to the Pembroke Chapel and they've got there a blue cross made of the wood of one of the refugee boats that came from Syria. And I wrote this little poem which they're now using.
Isn't that wonderful? Yeah. Where is it?
It's in the chapel.
Yeah, so people going to the chapel can see the poem.
Yeah.
Oh,
so help them understand the cross.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is the little first one, and you'll all remember the little boy that was carried ashore by the soldier. It's called They Are Found in the Sea. The Mediterranean, my world is the sea. Through a baby, my eyes the sky. Cold as a seal, my brothers are birds. Into shoreline waves, they wear beaks. Into dehydrated oil, they wear feathers. I couldn't leave him. They struggle to breathe. In that shell of a mortuary, I call for my mother. When the winds try to stand upright, turn back to Syria, but the boat won't listen. I will bury him, bury me, in a web of olive leaves, in the pelt of trees. Wick. From the flicker of a boat in the Aegean Sea, they took the heart. They built a cross, a twisted pale blue beak. The sky they followed, still and blue, like the toddler carried ashore by a soldier, carried through our televisions the terrible cries of his father. That cross in a bowl of votive candles in the chapel at Pembroke. Every candle, a voice between wick and flame. A Syrian refugee who never arrived.
Yes, one of many that really tug the heartstrings, and you're asking us to listen, and you're saying the world isn't hearing, aren't you?
Yeah. It is a shame how we move on and try and push these voices away.
But yeah, the images come back to haunt us, but we do push them away. And even one of the poem that you're going to read now, or parts of this long poem at the end, a sustained poem, isn't it, on Where Will the Fish Sleep?
Yeah, and it's divided into little sections A, B, C, D, and these are kind of answers to that multi-choice question. And this is one of the little series. These two run together, especially about the tsunami in Japan after our big earthquake here. A few days later in Japan, there was that terrible tsunami. And as I speak, there's just been a large earthquake in Japan this morning.
I know. It's a restless place.
It's terrible.
Like us.
Yeah, that's right. Restless.
Mm.
So this is the first part. A, they never thought the sea. The sea climbed a tall ladder, looking for a room in Ishio no Maki. She flung full-grown ships over bathhouses, penthouses, hilltop houses, and ripped out windows, side-kicked buildings, left debris seen from space. Tokiko's mother lifting her sister. Tokiko's mother wrestling water. Tokiko's mother not answering Tokiko, falling with the tide, under the monkey bridge shrine, under the willows, under the emperor's kind words, live-streamed from Tokyo. And the next little one that follows on, this is a true story I read about a man who lost his wife in the tsunami and was begging her to come home, and she got swept away. But after that, he gave up his job and really his life, and every day now he dives in the sea looking for his wife. It's called After the Tsunami, The Diver. Waves of ghosts, red flags where they sank. Waves of ghosts, hollow bones of houses, offices, dried fish factories. Waves of ghosts, shrunken heads of marine birds. Waves of ghosts, someone's single legs. Waves he daily dives like a slow sinking moon in search of his banker wife. Now 6 years, now 2190 days. Her last text, our manager orders us to lie on the roof. Any shadow could be hers. Any silence, the space between her eyes. The tick, tick, tick of his tank flicks through this calendar, their life together. Even under the waves, ghosts arrive without her and hang around him and float into his arms, kind like strangers.
Well, Karen, you've done a remarkable job in putting this collection together. What do you feel like at the end of it now that it's here in front of us?
I feel alarmed. I'm pleased to see it and I love it, and it feels like it's got a beating heart. And then I'm terrified to write anything else. but I have something.
Is there a clear division once you've finished a collection? Does it take you a while to not pick yourself up, but kind of say goodbye to that collection and feel, I don't know, detached enough to start again?
Yeah, I think there is. I think it's almost like a grieving time. And with me, it's a coming back to earth time because I've had such a wonderful response. And now I pick up my outfits and head off to my writing hut and begin again.
But
it's strange.
Do you ever feel that you've finished with the
topics
and themes? No, you can't.
I can't get away from this now. So there'll be little threads following me.
Yeah, and your little votive animals.
Yeah.
This time it's an elephant.
Yeah, that's right.
Last time it was a rabbit.
I can't get away from them.
No, I think the elephants will be following you.
Yes, and this next one is called Hoof, and there's a horse. It's quite prominent.
Well, Hoof, I in my years of being around you, lovely, productive and memorable years, the word hoof often came up. So I will be intrigued to see what's in this next collection.
Oh, that's great.
Kieran's latest collection is called Louder. It's by Kieran P. Sharp and it's by Victoria University Press. Thank you, Kieran.
Thanks, Maureen.
And join us, Maureen Rout and Ruth Todd, next Tuesday on Bookends on Plains FM 96.9.